Good morning, and welcome to Overeaters Anonymous, a Vision for You Big Book Study. My name is Katie F., and I'm a compulsive overeater. Today is Friday, May 12, 2017. Today we are reading from the Big Book, Chapter 3, and we are at page 39, the first paragraph. Today's readers are, for the 12 steps, Sally A., for the 12 traditions, Karen C., and reading the text is Leah S. The reference numbers for Thursday, May 11th, 2017 are for 7 a.m., 9929, and 10 a.m., 9930. That's 9929 and 9930. OA Preamble. Overeaters Anonymous is a fellowship of individuals who, through shared experience, strength, and hope, are recovering from compulsive overeating. We welcome everyone who wants to stop eating compulsively. There are no dues or fees for members. We are self-supporting through our own contributions, neither soliciting nor accepting outside donations. OA is not affiliated with any public or private organization, political movement, ideology, or religious doctrine. We take no position on outside issues. Our primary purpose is to abstain from compulsive eating and compulsive food behaviors and to carry the message of recovery through the 12 steps of OA to those who still suffer. Our sole purpose. OA's fifth tradition states, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the compulsive overeater who still suffers. At a Vision for You Big Book Study, our message is that people who suffer from compulsive overeating can recover through abstinence and the practice of the 12 steps and 12 traditions of Overeaters Anonymous. I will now ask Sally A. to read the 12 steps.
Good morning. Good morning, A Vision for You. It's Sally A., recovered in New York. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. The 12 steps. Step one, we admitted we were powerless over food, that our lives had become unmanageable. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Step five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Step six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Step seven, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. Step eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Step nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Step 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to compulsive overeaters and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Thank you for letting me do service.
Thank you, Sally. I will now ask Karen C. to read the 12 traditions.
Good morning, Katie. Can you hear me?
I can.
This is Karen C. I'm very grateful, recovered by God's grace, compulsive overeater. The 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon OA unity. Two, for our group purpose, There is but one ultimate authority, a loving God. He may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for OA membership is a desire to stop compulsively overeating. 4, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or OA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the compulsive overeater who still suffers. 6, an OA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the OA name to any related facility or outside enterprise. Thus, problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every OA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Overeaters Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, OA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Overeaters Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the OA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And 12, anonymity is a spiritual foundation of all of our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Thank you for allowing me to do service, Katie, and I pass.
Thank you so much, Karen. Okay, how our meeting works. Our meeting focuses on the directions for recovery described in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We read a paragraph or two from the literature, then stop and share on what was read. Anyone can share, but we ask that you keep your sharing to the topic and literature we're discussing, and that you keep your share to approximately 3 minutes. Singleness of purpose reminds us to identify as compulsive overeaters only. Our abstinence requirement for moderators is 1 year, and for readers is 6 months. There is no abstinence requirement for sharing on topic. This meeting does request that your sharing be directly linked to what was read. We are sharing what the directions in the Big Book mean to us. To share, press star 1 to unmute. Once you are done sharing, let us know by saying pass, then press star 1 to mute your phone. In order to have a quiet meeting, everyone's phone except the speakers should be muted. Today, we resume our study of the Big Book. We're in chapter 3, page 39. And I will ask Leah S. to begin reading. And she's going to be reading two paragraphs. And we will focus our comments on the second paragraph, which is about Fred. Okay, go ahead, Leah S.
Good morning, Katie. Thank you so much, everybody. Good morning. This is Leah S., a recovered compulsive overeater. That may be true of certain non-alcoholic people who, though drinking foolishly and heavily at the present time, are able to stop or moderate because their brains and bodies have not been damaged as ours were. The actual or potential alcoholic, with hardly an exception, will be absolutely unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. This is a point we wish to emphasize and reemphasize to smash home upon our alcoholic readers, as it has been revealed to us out of bitter experience. Let us take another illustration. Fred is a partner in a well-known accounting firm. His income is good. He has a fine home. He is happily married and is the father of promising children of college age. He has attractive personality. He makes friends with everyone. If ever there was a successful businessman, it is Fred. To all appearance, he is a stable, well-balanced individual, yet he is an alcoholic. We first saw Fred about a year ago in the hospital where he had gone to recover from a bad case of jitters. It was his first experience of this kind, and he was much ashamed of it. Far from admitting that he was an alcoholic, he told himself he came to the hospital to rest his nerves. The doctors intimated strongly that he might be worse than he realized. For a few days, he was depressed about his condition. He made up his mind to quit drinking altogether. It never occurred to him that perhaps he could not do so, in spite of his character and standing. Fred would not believe himself an alcoholic, much less accept a spiritual remedy for his problem. We told him what we knew about alcoholism. He was interested and conceded that he has some of the symptoms, but he was a long way from admitting that he could do nothing about it himself. He was positive that this humiliating experience, plus the knowledge that he had just acquired, would keep him sober for the rest of his life, and self-knowledge would fix this. What a powerful paragraph. Okay, so this is Leah S. And what I'd like to say is that we just read about Jim and the Jay Walker and things that we're really trying to identify who is a compulsive overeater. If I don't concede to myself, to my innermost self, that I am a person who cannot control some certain foods, then I am doomed. I am doomed. And that is in the very, very first step. That no matter what went on in my life until now, if I don't admit that I cannot control this food, then I'm not gonna be able to grasp this program. This program is a wonderful program. This program is a program for life, and living in the 12 steps has really, really helped with every area of my life that I didn't even think about. I really was not a fat girl. I was a compulsive overeater, but I did not know, I did not connect that. But it came out later in life that I couldn't control myself, that I used to go yo-yoing from my diets up and down. And I thank God that I found Overeaters Anonymous, and especially that I found a vision for you. And thank you. With that, I'll pass.
Thank you, Leah S. Okay, we're on page 39, starting with the sentence, Fred is a partner, and we will be focusing our comments on that paragraph. Who would like to share?
Matt M.
Okay, I'm not hearing anybody, so talk to Larry.
Matt,
I think it's Larry.
Harlan G.
Matt M.
Janice M.
Matt M. Larry K. Nessa.
Matt
M. U-L.
Matt, I have you about 12 times.
Sorry, honey.
Thank you.
Chrissy G.
Chrissy G.
Janice M.
Amanda R. Janice M.
Do L.
Okay, sorry, Matt. I didn't mean to be snarky. Okay, we have Larry K., Matt M., Harlan G., Nessa R., Chrissy G., Amanda R., Janice M., and Do L. We'll just go with those eight to start. So go ahead, Larry K., followed by Matt M.
Okay, thanks so much. Larry K., recovered compulsive reader from Chicago. You know, so we're reading about Fred here, and, one of the things that I draw out from this particular paragraph about Fred, because the whole point of this is to identify in, and for me, you know, when we read about Fred, here's a guy who, look, it says, you know, he was a partner in an accounting firm. This is a professional guy. He's got a good income, good family life at home. He's married. He has children. And this guy has such an attractive personality that he makes friends with everyone. I mean, it sounds like his life is going just wonderful. You know, he might be a little bit different, say, than Jim or the jaywalker in terms of, you know, of his life. And here it is, you know, we read that to all appearances, this guy appears stable. And I could relate to that. You know, in many respects, to the outside world, I appeared stable. There was lots of evidence that, you know, things were going reasonably well in my life professionally, had a family, roof over my head, car in the garage, the whole deal. Yet what I draw, so I can identify with Fred, and it says the doctor intimated strongly that he might be worse than he realized. So this guy began to cultivate some self-knowledge, and he was interested. He even conceded, as I had done, that he had some of the symptoms, but he was a long way from admitting that he could do nothing about it himself. And that's why I had to identify in with Fred. I really could, because I continued to try to make changes. But like Fred, you know, regardless of how humiliating the experience was for me, and with all the knowledge in the world that I had, self-knowledge, I thought for a time would fix this, but it wouldn't. See, I had the allergy of the body, and I came to understand with greater depth that I had this obsession of the mind that would drive me back, regardless of my professional life, regardless of my intellect, regardless of any self-knowledge that I had about myself, I would be driven back again and again to this disease. And so the biggest thing that I pull from here is identifying in, doesn't matter how good your life is going, if you're a pickle, you're a pickle. And I'm a pickle. Grateful pickle. And with that, I'll pass. Thanks.
Okay, Larry the Pickle. Thank you. Now we have Matt M., followed by Harlan G.
Thank you, moderator. I'm sorry for that. I didn't hear my name get called. This is Matt M. This is Matt M., compulsive overeater from New Jersey. Fred has a lot in common also with the man of 30. He was a drinker, but he had everything going for him as well. You know, he has a career. This guy has a family. The man of 30 didn't have a family, but he had a successful career just like Fred. And there's a lot of ego in this first paragraph, these first two paragraphs. He might think he has an alcoholic. He just doesn't want to admit it, though. Even he thinks he could do it based on self-knowledge alone. It says that he was positive this humility experience, but the knowledge he had acquired would keep him sober the rest of his life. Self-knowledge would fix it. I don't know about him, but for me, self-knowledge didn't fix much, you know. I make myself too smart for my own good for this program. I'm definitely intelligent, able-bodied in other parts of my life, but when it comes to the food, I am totally powerless. I have no control whatsoever with the food. And there's a lot of ego, and ego stands for easing God out, you know. And I hear a lot of arrogance there in his tone, and just by the way he's describing himself. And that fits me to a T, you know. I definitely understand now that I am a compulsive overeater, the hopeless variety. It takes a village to raise a compulsive overeater. I know I have a lot of people in my corner, especially here on the meeting, and other friends from other areas of the program and also in and out of the program. I'm just very grateful that I know I'm not alone in this process, because believe me, if I was alone in this process, I'd be dead. Because you don't get to 650 pounds overnight. It took years of compulsive overeating for me to get there, which means it was years and years of not having a life whatsoever. I've always been obese, so I can definitely relate, you know, to these stories in this chapter, because it tells me that, I can get to as bad as I think I can, and I have, you know. And with that, I'll pass. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt. Okay, Harlan G., you're up, followed by Nessa R.
Good morning, Katie. This is Harlan G. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater in Scottsdale, Arizona. Sorry, can I be heard? Sorry,
yes,
can
perfect.
I? Oh, thank you. The story of Fred is really taken from something that is in real life, a person that was originally in the original 100. When the big book was being printed, Hank Parkhurst and Bill Wilson went to some of the members so that they could buy stock in Works Publishing Company, and one of the early members named Harry Brick actually bought quite a number of the shares of stock because he was indeed a partner in a well-known accounting firm, and his story appears in the first edition, and the title of the story is A Different Slant. So if you have a copy of it, A Different Slant, this is where this story is taken from. This story illustrates the fact that in order to, it illustrates a couple of things so far, that you don't have to be in the gutter to be an alcoholic. And that's one of the things that's very, very important about this. But if we take a look at something here, very key, when the big book wants to tell me something, it tells it to me many times in different ways. Bottom of 39. Fred would not believe himself an alcoholic. He wouldn't take step one. If you don't take step one, much less accept a spiritual remedy for his problem, you don't need two. We told him what we knew of alcoholism, top of 40, and what we knew of alcoholism, what they're telling him is what Silkworth told them, of the allergy of the body and the twist of the mind. He was interested and conceded he had some of the symptoms, but he was a long way from admitting he could do nothing about it himself. He was positive that this humiliating experience, plus the knowledge he had acquired, would keep him sober the rest of his life. Self-knowledge would fix it. If I go back to page 7, it says here on page 7, you don't have to flip back if you're driving to work, my incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. I'm in Bill's story. Understanding myself, now I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. I went to town regularly and even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. But it was not, for the frightful day came when I drank once more. So once again, we are leaning on this information that really comes to us from the common sense of drinking by Peabody. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. There are people on this line right now that are 20 times smarter than I'll ever be in my life. And there are people on this line that may not be, whatever it is. It doesn't matter. As Larry says, he's a pickle. I'm a pickle. We will never go back to being cucumbers again. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. And if I do not work these steps, as much as this disease has ripped me to shreds, I will return to the food, and I will do so like a dog to its master, because the only way I have of relieving the intense pain of not eating Oreo cookies is to eat Oreo cookies, unless I work the steps and have a spiritual awakening as the result of those steps. Those are my only two choices. And next week, we're going to see where Fred goes from here. And with that, I'll pass. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Thank you, Harlan. Okay, Nessa R., you're up, followed by Chrissy G.
Thank you. Good morning, Vision for You. This is Nessa R., a recovered compulsive overeater in Toronto, Canada. And hats off to you, Katie, for making sense of the jumble of desperate voices wanting to share. So I love the shares that have preceded mine. I just want to take a different slant because here we have Fred, who is successful by any measure, by any stretch of the imagination. He's got a high-power career in which he does well. He's got a lot of money. He probably has a big house. He's well-respected in his profession. He seems to have a nice family. And how many times did I say to myself, if only I had more money, I wouldn't have to eat. If only my life wasn't so stressful, if only, you know, my children got along, if only I had a big house, you know, all these if onlys that kept me in the food, you know, I blamed my addiction on the circumstances. And here we have Fred showing us that it is not the circumstances that drive us to our drug of no choice. It is not the circumstances that keep us there because, you know, based on the circumstances, Fred has absolutely no reason to drink, but he does. He does because he has an allergy of the body and an obsession of the mind that keep them in the cycle of disease that we learn about in the doctor's opinion. And it is the same thing with me with regards to food. It is not the circumstances that drive me to the food. By the same token, you know, it is not the circumstances that will help or hinder my recovery. Circumstances are just external factors. You know, the only thing that will help or hinder my recovery is the extent to which I am committed to the approach I outline in this book, to the extent that I do my best to work this program of recovery, which means following the instructions outlined in the big book, in the 12 steps, in entire abstinence. It doesn't matter that my life is stressful. It doesn't matter that I have no time. It doesn't matter that I'm too busy doing this or doing that. You know, those are just circumstances. The same way that the circumstances, you know, do not make me an addict, it is not the circumstances that will help me or prevent me from being recovered. And with that, I pass.
Thank you so much, Nessa. Chrissy G, you're up, followed by Amanda R.
Hi, Katie. It's Chrissy G, recovered compulsive overeater and anorexic from New Jersey. And they're cautionary tales, and, you know, my ears need to perk up when I hear these stories, and I need to be able to see myself in them. And I'm working with a lot of people right now who, like me, are too smart, you know, for their own good, and analyze and try to think the bite through, try to think the binge through, and, you know, do this game where, okay, maybe it's the egg whites. Maybe I have to eliminate the grain. You know, that's what caused the binge. And trying to think their way through to abstinence. And I have to tell you, it's such a hindrance. And it says it in the 12 and 12 in the book of AA, the 12 steps and 12 traditions. It says that it talks about two blocks to getting sober. And one of them is being too smart, and the other one is a block with the higher power when you actually have faith and lost it. You know, those are two of the biggest blocks, and I see them. I see them so often in people who are struggling. So I think that this is like a really important thing to look at, to really search your own, search yourself if you're struggling, and say, am I using my own analysis of this disease to try to fix it? Or am I being teachable and saying, okay, you show me, you tell me, because that's a really important quality to have when getting abstinent. With that, I pass.
Thank you, Chrissy. Amanda R., you're up, followed by Janice M.
Hello, this is Amanda R. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater in Maine. And what jumped out at me this morning was most of the way through that paragraph where it says, he made up his mind to quit drinking altogether. It never occurred to him that perhaps he could not do so. And it made me think of this time just a little while back where I was leaving a local meeting that I'd been to. And as we're heading out to the parking lot, somebody said to me, don't eat no matter what. And apparently, I didn't realize at the time, apparently what you're supposed to respond is, no matter what, don't eat. And the more they told me that, that's how it went. And I kind of thought about that afterwards. And the more I think about it, the more it kind of makes me sad, because that is the message of, I am determined. I am going to beat this thing. I am, by my willpower, I am not going to eat no matter what. And, you know, I don't know, perhaps I misunderstood it. But I think it could easily be construed that way. And there's a lot more to this program than just don't eat no matter what. There's a lot more than, you know, just desperately resisting the food. Because, number one, that's just not going to work. If for an addict, that's not, that's just plain old fails sooner or later. But beyond that, that desperate resisting of whatever food, there's freedom and transformation and just a new life on the other side of these steps where we don't care about, I mean, I've got some of my, somebody gave me jelly beans for Easter, and they're sitting over here on the top of my bookcase waiting for one of my friends to come by so I can give them to them because I don't want them. And, I mean, they're about as interesting to me as a bowl of marbles. And really, it's possible to get there where we care about life and living it instead of food and eating it and eating it and eating it and resisting it and then eating it and resisting it. And I don't know. So, I don't know, I just offer that hope to people, and I pass.
Thank you, Amanda. Okay, Janet M., you're up, and then we'll have Duell, and then we'll open it up for more.
Well, thank you so much, Katie F., for your service, and good morning to everyone. My name is Janice M., and I'm a grateful, recovered, compulsive overeater. Oh, what she has, all these illustrations. You know, from the time of the man of 30 to, you know, continuing on to Jim, et cetera. Now we have Fred. So what it shows to me is my disease does not care one bit about who I am, what kind of car I drive, how much money I have in the bank, what kind of what my husband does for a living. My disease does not care if I'm in the gutter or if I'm up on the mountain. It doesn't care. It doesn't, you know, it happens to everybody. But the illustrations show me one thing. Not knowing, the disease doesn't care who I am, but you know what? We all get the same result from the disease, no matter who we are. Because if I am a compulsive overeater, and I have to be convinced of that, because there's no, I mean, I have to be convinced that I do not have the power. Now, of course, if I still think that I have the power, then I don't need a power in my life. So if I don't, you know, if I don't have the step one, I can't go to step two. I mean, it's obvious because I'm going to still be finding a way, trying to find a way to get rid of this disease. And, of course, I know once I have it, that's it. That's it. So, you know, the self-knowledge has to be smashed. Who I am has to be smashed. My pride has to be smashed. You know, I think, oh, God, you know, I won't be like them. I won't kill. I may gossip, but I'm not going to kill. And I'm not going to get 500 pounds. No, no. And I'm not going to get diabetes. See, that's all pride. And pride is the leader of, you know, pride before the fall. So we all have one thing in common, all these illustrations, is that the thinking, I am powerless, I don't have the power, I cannot stop, and I cannot stay stopped because I don't have any willpower. And, you know, if you notice on the top of page 40, even the fellowship, you know, they you know, had a 12-step call. Fred had a 12-step call. He, you know, we got the information. That's not going to help us. The fellowship is wonderful. I wouldn't be here every day if I didn't need it. And wanted. But that's not going to give me my spiritual awakening. That's the problem, because I'll still have the problem. There has to be a power greater than myself. All these men, they have to find a power in order to get spiritual awakening so that they can have that obsession of the mind removed. And thank you much. Pass.
Thank you, Janet. Okay, Duell, you're up.
Good morning. This is Duell, recovered compulsive overeater from New York. And I love this self-knowledge. You know, I was just reflecting on how many people I sponsor. I sponsor doctors. I sponsor nurses. I sponsor lawyers. I sponsor professors. And they're pretty, you know, they're smarter than I could ever be. But one thing they all had in common is they couldn't stay abstinent. And my favorite was nutritionists, sponsoring a nutritionist. Boy, I tell you. Or people that in real time, you know the big book, but can't stay abstinent. And this is not about self-knowledge. This is not about what you know. Because people come into program they get abstinent, they think that's the solution. And, you know, a couple of weeks later, a month later, 2 months later, they break their abstinence. And they're wondering why they can't get this program. Other people, you know, work the steps, they're doing pretty good. Step 9, step 4, they're back in relapse. Why are they not getting it? You know, and if you don't get the most important part of this program, which is you need to collaborate, work with, cooperate with your higher power in order to work this program. If you think that you're going to do this alone by yourself because you are smart enough, you think you're intelligent enough, you think you don't have enough manageability in your life, you're not going to get this program. I know from experience because that was my experience. You know, I came into program thinking I knew it all. Don't tell me how to work this program. I can read the book. I can figure it out myself. Well, you know what? It took me years and years of being in misery. It wasn't until I surrendered, put down my food, and turned to a higher power that this program really began to work for me. You know, and it takes action. You know, this is about practicing the program. And what is practicing? Practicing to surrender, practicing to give up things, you know, in our lives. And letting the results, not trying to get the results, letting the results come from higher power, not trying to get them. And once I let go of control, I was able to get the recovery. So the steps are 12. It's not just one. It's not just about putting down the food. It's about working through these steps with your higher power to get that transformation of a new and exciting life, you know, and a new way of thinking and a new way of being. And with that, I pass.
Thank you, Du. Okay. Who else would like to share?
Sally.
Barbara E.
Leah M.
Melissa C.
Okay, I have Barbie Sally B. A, Barbara E, Leah M, Melissa C. Who else? Rock. I thought
Sparky
it was
B.
Rocky. I'm sorry. Could you say that slower?
Sparky B.
Sparky B. I don't think that's
yes.
what you're saying.
Oh, Sparky. Okay. Yes.
Okay. Great.
Thanks.
Okay. Okay, Sally A, followed by Barbara E, then Leah M, Melissa C, and Sparky B. Go ahead, Sally.
Thank you. Good morning, A Vision for You. It's Sally A in New York. A very grateful, recovered, compulsive overeater. And I guess what's really important for me this morning to say is we see that we keep hearing these words, that it's not about self-knowledge, unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. And often we have to look at our motive for what we're doing. So why are we on this meeting every morning? What are we here for? Are we here to grow our knowledge? Are we here to know more than we knew yesterday? Is there something we're going to find out here that's going to turn a key and change our thinking so that we stop eating compulsively? And the truth that I have found for myself is that my motive for being here for so long was not the right motive. My motive was self-knowledge, but what I have learned now is that what I have is a connection disorder. It's more than this eating disorder. The eating disorder is a byproduct of my connection disorder. I have a connectivity disorder. So what are you saying, Sally? I'm saying my focus has been be abstinent. Do this, do this, do this, do this, do this. And these do's, we have to do these do's to put the food down, that's true, and I'm not knocking the do's. But what I am saying is that the real problem is my connection to you and my connection to God. That's the truth.
I say to myself on a daily basis, Sally, don't focus on being abstinent today. That's not what's going to get you abstinent. Get focused on getting connected to God. And a few people that God puts in your path to be connected to so that you can be more connected to God. That is what will help you put the food down and the food thoughts. That is what will lead you to where you're supposed to be. Be connected. Thanks for letting me share with that, Akash.
Thank you, Sally. Okay, Barbara E., you're up, followed by Leah M.
Thank you so much. Hello, everyone. A beautiful sunny day in New Jersey. I always said I did not have a higher power. All I needed was a good food plan, and I had many good food plans, and they all worked until I stopped working them because I was arrogant. When I came into Overeaters Anonymous 20 years ago, I said, I don't have a higher power. And someone said to me, where do you go for comfort? Where do you go when you're awake? Where do you go when you're sad? And the answer, of course, was my refrigerator. And she said, well, there's your higher power. It's in your refrigerator. And it's true. I would go to pray at my refrigerator, open the door and look at it and look at it and choose something in the middle of night. That's why I always said there's a light in the refrigerator. But I do believe I have a higher power now that is not centered in my kitchen and is not centered in Dunkin' Donuts or is not centered in the pizza shop. I have a higher power that comes from a different source. I saw a movie way back, and some of you, as old as I, may remember it, The Harder They Fall, Humphrey Bogart. It was a fight movie. I was a child. That's the story of my life. Every time I went back into the food, and I did 7 times before I got here, every time I went back in the food, it was another fall down into an even deeper crevasse. I never thought I'd crawl my way back up. I had messages, but I ignored them. I did not think I needed the steps. On Wednesday, I went to the Bronx Botanical Garden to see the Chihuly glass exhibit. Wonderful. There was Chihuly glass at the top of the library there on the 6th floor. I didn't realize there was an elevator. I took the steps. I took them 1 step at a time. I'm not capable of taking 2 at a clip. Same thing with my program. I have to take the steps 1 step at a time. And if I didn't, as was said earlier, admit step 1, then I couldn't go on to step 2 and certainly never accept step 3. Today, 20 years later, I'm at that point. I know my higher power is not centered in my self-will, in my arrogance, or in my kitchen. It's a place of wonderment, and every time I go on this meeting, I hear it over and over again. Thank you all. Have a good weekend.
Thank you, Barbara. Leah M., you're up, followed by Melissa C.
Thank you so much. Fred would not believe himself an alcoholic, much less accept a spiritual remedy for his problem. Well, Fred's going to have to experience some more pain until he's beaten into a state of reasonableness, and I get that. That certainly was the case for me, and it is certainly the case for people, you know, that I've worked with over the years. And, you know, it is remarkable, you know. It is remarkable because, you know, compulsive overeaters, especially smart compulsive overeaters who have been around the big book, who know the text, you know, it just magnifies the nature of addiction. you know, why do we defy and delay and deny and resist? That's addiction. It's the only disease known to man where the sufferer has no enthusiasm for recovery. You know, you're given the opportunity to arrest an illness and have a whole new life. And yet, compulsive overeaters will often say, I'll give that thought. My life's too busy. I've got other things going on. It's just the nature of the beast. You know, compulsive overeaters of my type, against all the evidence, I mean, most people, much like our fellowship, have been around Overeaters Anonymous for years, most for decades. But compulsive overeaters of my type, against all evidence, persist by saying, I'm not really like that, therefore I do not have to do these things. And that's the nature of compulsive overeating. It is cunning. It is baffling. It is powerful. It's comical, but it's tragic at the same time. Because what other disease can you think of? If someone was diagnosed with cancer, if someone's diagnosed with AIDS, you know, different people who have cancer, except they have cancer. Here we are, real compulsive overeaters. We act like we're compulsive overeaters. We look like we're compulsive overeaters. We have the history of compulsive overeating, yet our mind says we're not really compulsive overeaters. Therefore, we do not have to do the things that you do. And it seems to be the only disease known to man where the person has no enthusiasm for recovery. And I had to get beaten to that pulp, because unless I humble myself by taking step one and saying, I am done, I cannot do this, I don't need the rest of the program, because if I think I have the power over food, I have the power over this disease, then I do not need to believe in a power greater than myself to restore me to sanity. And if I don't believe that, then I don't have to turn my will and my life over to that power. And if I don't do that, well, I don't have to do steps 4 through 9, because that's the essence of step 3. And if I don't do inventory steps, then I certainly don't have to continue to take inventory in step 10, improve my conscious contact daily with God, and step 12. It's a recipe for disaster. I'm just wrapping up, because step 1, denial, plus pride, plus arrogance, plus self-reliance, plus entitlement, forget it. You know, get ready for more beating. And with that, I pass.
Thank you, Leah. Melissa C., you're up, followed by Sparky B.
Hi, good morning, everyone. It's Melissa C., recovered compulsive overeater in New York. And, you know, I'm thinking about that humiliation, you know, that here he is, he's humiliated. And so he thought, all right, the embarrassment, and now some knowledge. I'm not really as bad as this. I don't need any spiritual help. I have some self-knowledge now. I have the pain, the bite of a painful experience, and that's going to keep me, you know, from picking up. And, you know, and of course, I could write a novel about all the humiliating experiences that I endured, and it was never enough to keep me from returning to picking up again and again. Because somewhere I did not believe that I really had this. You know, I thought that I was smart. And I had evidence, like other people had said, of what looked like a good, normal life. I had all the things that qualify for what a normal life is. And so surely I can't have this. But, you know, humiliation is really, it is a powerful teacher. And in other areas of my life, when I was humiliated, when I was embarrassed, my behavior changed. You know, when I was young, I had my first credit card, and I ran up a debt that I needed help to pay off, and I was really embarrassed and humiliated, and I paid it off. But, you know, thank God, that addiction is not my addiction. And so I learned from the pain of my humiliation. I didn't necessarily need a program to help me with that. This addiction, you know, my compulsive overeating, humiliation was not enough. But my humiliation was important, because what it did do was, from enough time, from enough pain, it told me that I am powerless. you know, that I was going to repeat it again and again. And humiliation allowed me to actually fully take step one, that I conceded to my innermost self, I made the self-diagnosis that I needed a spiritual transformation. And thank you. With that, I'll pass.
Thank you so much, Melissa. Okay, Sparky B, you're up.
Recovered compulsive overeater from Scottsdale, Arizona. Thank you for letting me join your call today. I look at this and I see so much of myself and the appearances that I thought I was keeping up. He has so attractive a personality that he makes friends with everyone. To all appearances, he's a stable, well-balanced individual. Well, the thing is that I sort of had two modes of being before I came into the program. It was either I was on the food and I looked like I had my shit together, or I wasn't and I was crying my eyes out. I had two modes of living. It was eating and crying. And the fact is that while I had a business and, you know, I was moving forward in my life in some ways, in other ways, things weren't going, you know, while friends were going to grad school and taking out mortgages and getting married, I was paying my bills and using every last cent thereafter to go eat and, you know, comforting myself with food because I had nothing, no frame of reference for, you know, any other way to deal with the world. And the fact is, walking into a meeting and being able to bear my timid self and be around people who had found a way through it, through God and through the steps. And, you know, it seeing that it was possible was what let me one by one release these things that I was trying to manage by myself. I was, you know, I looked like I was doing a great job of doing, but really I was doing a crap job of managing it. And the fact is, only when I had a higher power and you know, saw that this higher power could first keep me out of the food and then help me live a life of service and a life beyond my wildest dreams, was I able to move through that. And I mean, the fact of this program at this point, when I wasn't eating before, I would have such high tension, full body emotional tension that I didn't know, you know, left from right. And when I was eating, I was so sedate that if a house was on fire, I wouldn't be moved. And because of recovery now, I can get a little twist in my stomach when I feel like I've misstepped or misspoken or something. And because I'm working strong 10 steps, promptly admitting that I'm wrong, find my part, see where resentments are coming from, and throughout the day, turn these things over to God and the fellow and to be of service to others. These things, living honestly, being present, and actually letting my emotions, you know, come through and being okay with everything, and knowing that all of that stuff is finite, and the higher power that delivered me from food obsession and delivers me on a daily basis can get me through, it's a miracle. And with that, I'll pass.
Thank you. Okay, well, I'm going to take the last 2 minutes. I'm Katie F., a recovered compulsive overeater in Virginia. And this line, he was positive that this humiliating experience plus the knowledge he had acquired would keep him sober the rest of his life. Self-knowledge would fix it. And I thought, I had that thought when I was 14 years old. That's when I went to my first OA meeting. And I just thought, well, that's very interesting, but, you know, I just don't think I'm quite as bad as you people. So, you know, I'm going to go prove that I don't need this. And, you know, I came back, you know, crawled slightly back in at 21, but still just kept getting self-knowledge. And would not, you know, fully concede to my innermost self that I was a compulsive overeater. I just thought that, you know, I needed to change all these external things and then I would be okay. So this disease has a way of plummeting you into reality. You know, as several have shared this morning, once you're a pickle, you can't go back to being a cucumber. And I love that analogy because it is so, you know, I have made pickles before, and, you know, it goes through a real process, and there's just absolutely no way you can turn that back into a fresh cucumber. And I am the same way. I had to, you know, basically double my weight from when I came in at 14 until I finally surrendered at 27. You know, that's, I had to live another life before I would accept the fact that I had this illness and that I was never going to be able to eat like regular people. And I'm so grateful to accept that today and to let go of my thinking and to trust other people. Well, sorry. Okay. Okay, so that we are now at 7:55. So thank you to everyone who shared. Please join us for a second unrecorded hour study immediately following closing. The share ID for today, May 12th, is 9933. That's 9933. We will now close with the reading from the Big Book on page 164, followed by the Serenity Prayer. Will Tina S. please read A Vision for You? Our book is meant to be suggestive only.
Thanks, Katie. Tina S., recovered compulsive eater, anorexic in Florida. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.